Sounds. Wake up to money from BBC.
Hello, good morning. How do you follow that from Dotton? We will try because it is Wake Up to Money on this Wednesday morning. It's the 14th of April, just after 5 o'clock. I don't think any singing in our programme today, but how has our biggest supermarket dealt with our biggest demands? Tesco is going to say how it's done through a pandemic that has completely changed our view of how we shop. Another day, a new set of lobbying scandal headlines, alongside this time pictures of David Cameron's camping in a suit with the boss of the now bust finance company, Greensill Capital. How did it get to this point? We're going to start at the very beginning. Plus, why British Gas staff are striking, as today is the deadline for engineers to sign a new contract or leave the business.
Wake up to money with Sean Farrington.
Good morning to you. I hope you are well. If you're a few days in, have you got the two-day hangover after that boozy lunch on Monday that you've been keeping an eye on for a while? If you're able to get to one of those pubs with a pub garden in England this week, have you got that lined up? But I'd still continue to let us know how your easing of lockdown is going. Have you accomplished something that you wouldn't have thought you'd been able to do a couple of months ago? Have you got that haircut? Have you got it booked? 85058, hashtag wake up to money if you want to get in touch with anything we're discussing on the show today. I've got Tab Ahmad with me, founder and chief executive of Employability. Morning to you, Tab.
Morning, Sean. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So Employability provides consultancy services to employers to create inclusive workspaces, support disabled students and graduates into employment as well. So many of the things that you come across in your role will be very applicable for what we're discussing on the show today. So thank you for being with us. How's your week going? Have you had any of those major appointments gone by yet?
Very, very busy work week. Haven't managed to get out to a restaurant just yet, but excitedly, we have got dinner booked tomorrow at a pub up the road, sitting out in the garden. So we're very excited about that.
The booking is there. What time of day is it?
Well, it's in the evening. That's the only slot we could get. So we just grabbed it anyway. It's at 8 o'clock in the evening, but we'll have our coats. I think they've got some outdoor heating.
Crucial.
And irrespective, we're super excited about it as a family.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like going on holiday, isn't it? I always think it's the kind of thing, you know, if I was going to Eastern Europe and it was freezing cold, I'd still happily have, you know, a meal outside and enjoy that experience. Why not do it in our local pubs now? That's what a lot of us going to have to do.
Exactly.
Great stuff. Tab, what about shopping for you? We're going to talk about Tesco now and the year it's had, the year that sector has had. Have you changed how you've done your big supermarket shop, if you even did one before the pandemic?
Yeah, so before the pandemic, we sort of regularly got things that we needed rather than very often doing a massive big shop, just to not waste things, really. Otherwise, we'd find we'd do a massive shop, bring loads of things that we thought were really healthy, like vegetables and fruit, and then end up not eating them because we've gone out for dinner. So in the pandemic, did a lot of online shopping at the beginning, particularly and when we couldn't get online shopping at the beginning, the very first lockdown, so almost a year ago, I used a lot of Amazon, actually.
Amazon, wow, yeah.
To do shopping for Amazon Fresh, but now I mean, my husband goes out and does kind of bigger shops, but occasionally do online shopping, occasionally Tesco's, but it's usually sort of Waitrose or even sometimes Morrison's.
So, yeah, the whole array of things. But that's fascinating. The idea, you probably would never have thought of getting your groceries from Amazon before the pandemic.
Never.
But when needs must, our habits change. You've done it once now. So, you know, in the back of your mind that that's a possibility if you need it again. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing they've been looking to roll out across the country. Well, I mean, supermarkets have stormed through the pandemic. They've been feeding the nation, taking advantage as well of the fact that for much of the last year, we haven't been able to go out to eat or visit many other shops. That florist I keep talking about that I spoke to in Barnsley Market on Monday, and she was saying to me how difficult it was for her to see the flowers being sold on Mother's Day in supermarkets near her when that's what she should have been doing. So there's been a big opportunity there for the supermarkets as well. We're going to find out what all that means for the profits of the UK's biggest grocer, Tesco, when it releases its full year results later on this morning. Not a straight thing, sales. Tesco has promised to pay back £585 million in business rates relief. It started that snowball effect across the industry and says it's faced extra COVID-related costs that could hit £810 million as well. There's that huge shift to online shopping, which is much less profitable for supermarkets the way we all use it. And we're going to talk about that now. I've got Maya Knights with me, who's a retail technology expert and author and owns the Retail Technology magazine. Morning, Maya.
Morning.
Morning. Thanks for being with us. I mean, what is it that Tesco have done over the last year to keep up with what us shoppers want?
Well, I think I was saying earlier, it's made it easier for us to shop online. Famously, around March, April last year, Tesco's announced that it had 1,000 new delivery slots and was ramping up and collecting capacity as well.
Maya, I'm just going to jump in a sec because I'm just going to let you reconnect the line with our technology experts as well and get rid of a few of those blips. So speak to you again in one very short moment. I've got Jane Foley with me, senior currency strategist at Rabobank. Hi, Jane.
Good morning, Sean.
Morning. And we've spoken about Tesco many, many times, but their full year results this time round are going to be a bit different than they have been before?
Well, in certain ways, yes, certainly in the breakdown, but maybe not so much in the numbers. I mean, they have said that what they will see is something perhaps similar in profits to what they saw in 2019 and 2020. And whilst we all know that supermarkets within the retail sector have been doing really quite well, because obviously we all have to eat, we've got to remember those costs that you mentioned had to make those stores safe, they had to hire more staff, and they've had more absences as well. So they've had to cope with more costs. And we've also got to remember, like you mentioned, that they said before the pandemic that Tesco was making a loss of 4% on each of the value of each of its online shop. Now, that's what's going to change, because since the pandemic, we've been doing amounts of shopping online, and that helps reduce their costs. So it's going to be interesting to see what they say about online. And of course, there's been other things too. There's been Booker. They have a part of that business, and there's Tesco Bank, and they already sold part of their mortgage business, or they sold their mortgage business to Lloyds, indicating that they want to move out of the banking business perhaps. So it'll be interesting to see what they say on that also.
Yeah, and there's a new boss as well, isn't there? You know, Ken Murphy took over sort of mid-pandemic from Dave Lewis, who many people think turned Tesco around. It doesn't feel that long ago that we were talking about accounting scandals at Tesco, and then Dave Lewis has come in and set the business up for what it's done in the pandemic. So it's a bit of a different type of whole business to look at now than it would have been a few years ago.
Yes, absolutely. It does seem a long time away since those scandals, as you say, have been turned around. So there's lots of different elements here, which are going to be really quite interesting, even though the actual numbers might be quite similar to what we saw before.
Yeah, fascinating. So that is why we always dig down into the small print on Wake Up to Money. Maya Knights, got your back, retail technology expert. Hi again, Maya.
Hi again, Sean.
Hi. So Maya, just talking about then that idea of online shopping being more expensive for supermarkets, certainly before the pandemic, and maybe as Jane says there, our bigger shops make that a little bit easier. But how have Tesco and the other supermarkets, I guess, managed to deal with that spike that you mentioned in online demand while also making money out of it?
Well, I think it remains to be seen whether they've made a huge amount of money. I mean, I think we're all aware of the fact that because the supermarkets were the only ones that have opened, they're the only ones that have been in a position to make money. But I think, as we heard earlier, their profits aren't going to actually be that much more than they were last year, if not slightly less, to reflect the added costs that they've had to swallow to deal with our growing demand for online. So they've had to open up new delivery slots, so that's drivers, vans, as well as new people in their warehouses, more shifts, more people to pick and pack and ship those goods And also the exceptional costs go on in store as well in terms of extra cleaning. The fact that the stores were open but were throttled in terms of the numbers of people that they could let in severely curtailed their earning potential as well. So there's lots of things that they've had to do to take into account for the safety features in store, as well as for the fact that we're staying away from store and shopping online, that have cost them more.
And Maya, when we see that, you know, the likes of Sainsbury's and the Co-op have deals with Deliveroo for us to get super quick convenience delivery of our shop, however frequently we might want to do that, you know, and other delivery companies have similar setups with whether it's the local garages, the local supermarkets, at your local garages, those kind of things. Are we going to hear anything from Tesco today about the outlook for 2021 and how are they going to continue to evolve in the future?
I think it is interesting that you're seeing even Aldi and Lidl trying to do online somehow. I think Sainsbury's announcement with Deliveroo yesterday is testament to the fact that they are trying any which way to get our groceries to us as quickly as possible from an online delivery perspective. That doesn't necessarily use their vans. They're using somebody else's system, somebody else's riders, Deliveroo riders. And I think Tesco's is going to be put under pressure to match that hour window delivery that you can get with Deliveroo, whereas I think it at the moment it's offering you next day. I doubt that it's actually going to jump at that at the moment. There doesn't, with demand the way it is, I can't see them wanting to push for anything that's going to make it even more expensive to get our groceries to us, given the exceptional cost that they've got, given the fact that they will have probably maintained their operating profit, and they have, they've had a really, really good year, all told, and they're busy divesting the banks and the businesses in Malaysia and Thailand, for example. I think Tesco's is going to be one of the last ones, possibly also because they've done so well over the last year, to actually go for this rapid hour-long delivery. If anything, they can use their local stores, like their metros, for example, to allow you to click and collect more rapidly without having to sort of brand by going with a delivery. I think it shows how desperate in that sense, unfortunately.
Very interesting. Jane, so that's sort of the technology outlook and how things might change for us to be able to shop. But at the end of the day, we're still... it's all about how much we're willing to spend. What are going to be the prospects for this year for Tesco in terms of getting money out of customers and getting people to shop with them?
Well, you know, quite interestingly, many people during the pandemic have been able to save a bit more. Now, this is because most of the jobs that have been lost and are likely to be lost are in lower paid occupations, leisure, hospitality, for instance. Everybody else who's kept their jobs have saved more. But of course, the question is, now that the other restaurants and shops are reopening, Tesco's going to have to compete a lot more with those for people's money. So again, there is a lot of uncertainty about that. Are we going to be spending less in the supermarket, more in restaurants? Quite likely. So they will have to fight a little bit harder, perhaps, to get the pennies out of our pockets.
Maya Knight, thank you for being with us this morning. Retail technology expert, author, also owns the Retail Technology magazine. Jane, plenty more to discuss. I've got short lists of... all kinds of things lined up. Babcock, we're talking SPACs and Grab in a moment. We'll explain what that is shortly. And what else is going on in the world? Let me know what's going on in your world at the moment. 85058, hashtag wake up to money. The boss of the British technology company Dyson has told the BBC he thinks Brexit's been a success and it's enabled the UK to get ahead in the vaccine rollout. This is Sir James Dyson, who's just announced plans to create 200 new research roles in the UK this year, alongside 250 more in Singapore. And as part of a $3.8 billion global investment, Hurst asked him how he thought Brexit had gone so far.
We've got our freedom. We can make trade agreements with other countries outside Europe. We can employ people from all around the world. We have 60 different nationalities here on this site, and we can now employ them from all over the world. Previously, we were now to employ people from Europe, and we couldn't get the engineers we needed. And I think much more than that, it gives us an independence of spirit. And that couldn't be better demonstrated than in the development of the vaccine. Mm-hmm. We weren't part of the European development of the vaccine. We had to develop our own. They did it brilliantly at Oxford, and AstraZeneca, a British company, took that up and produced it. And it's a world-beating vaccine produced in record time. And that's because we did it independently.
In terms of our relationship with the EU, there is still that regulatory red tape that is crushing some companies. We still have to meet EU standards in order to export there. Was there any point?
We have to meet standards in lots of different countries throughout the world. They're all different, and we have to meet them. And it's not a big deal. That's what we do. Okay. In some countries, we pay import duty. That's what you have to do as an exporter. It's not really a big issue. Actually, what's a far greater issue are currency fluctuations. They have a far greater influence on export, whether exports are profitable or not, than having to meet regulations or import duty.
But it is a big deal if you're a small business that just doesn't have the margin to take those changes.
Well, I don't know about those sort of details, but it's very sad if that is the case. Mm. But, you know, from the very beginning, when we were very, very small, and there were just a few of us here, we had to meet regulations in Europe, regulations in America when we started exporting there, and regulations in Japan and China and so on. It's just what you have to do.
So that was Sir James Dyson there talking to Nina Warhurst. Him and his company creating 200 jobs in the UK today, another 250 in Singapore. Should we go over to Singapore now? Speak to Katie Silver. Morning, Katie.
Good morning, Sean.
I always get the impression Singapore's so small. You may well share a cafe or a lobby with Sir James Dyson. Is that quite the case?
Well, yeah, oddly enough, we don't share the same lobby, but he does live about a couple of doors down from me. We actually share the same block.
Right. Okay. You see him
about. He bought one of the most expensive properties in Singapore a couple of years ago. And I mean, you can see the photos online. They're incredible. He owns two amazing properties in Singapore. He's actually just sold this one that is right by me. But yeah, an epic flat.
Oh, yeah. I can now see the. I didn't realise you lived in a place like this.
I don't. I'm a couple of doors down. Let's say I'm the dodgy end of the street.
I mean, yeah, that looks like a proper stately home, the dodgy. Yeah, when you say a couple of doors down, I'm now getting the impression that, you know, that still might be quite a decent walk as I look and read about his marble pool. And does he invite That's the neighbours nice. Round? Have you been to a house party there?
I would love to. I haven't actually met Sir Dyson yet, but maybe one day. I'll just keep hanging out around his lobby, perhaps.
Excellent.
Like a little stalker.
Lovely idea of that. There you go. Right. I was just about to say goodbye to you then, Katie, then realised I need to actually talk to you about
Please
what's
do.
Going on in the real world.
Yeah, let's chat.
So I mentioned earlier, Grab and SPAC. These are headlines that are making, you know, front pages of the Financial Times. We're talking multi-billion dollars. But I mean, it's another bit of jargon for us to get used to and another new company. Just explain what's going on here.
Absolutely. So Grab is basically like the Uber of Southeast Asia, but it's a little bit more than that. So it is for ride hailing, but it also does, for example, it does like Uber Eats, it does food, but it also does kind of investments. And it calls itself a super app, which are, you know, these apps from China that do or more or less everything for you. It doesn't do quite everything, but it does do a lot. Anyhow, it's still private, but it wants to list now on the New York Stock Exchange, and it's going to do so via a SPAC. And yeah, that is the other piece of jargon that we've all heard a lot of lately, particularly in the last year. And so a SPAC basically is when somebody creates a company that doesn't yet have any assets or revenue. And what they do is they go out, there might be a big high-profile investor, or even the likes of, for example, Serena Williams or Shaq O'Neal. They go out and they say, look, here's my SPAC. Would you like to invest in it? They list on a stock exchange. And there's sort of the expectation that they're going to hopefully, within 2 years, join up with another private company. And that way, investors like you or I can get an early ticket or get a ticket into one of these companies that you may not otherwise be able to buy when it lists on a stock exchange. So, yes, Grab is choosing to go public in this way. And it's been a $40 billion or $29 billion pound deal that's been, you know, come out overnight, basically.
I'm going to bring in Jane Foley here, head of FX strategy at Rabobank. Jane, SPACs, I mean, this would be a new term you'll have been using.
Social diversity, yeah.
Jane, you'll have been using a lot more this kind of terminology in the last year. Are they needed? Why weren't these around before?
they were around before. They've been around for quite a long time, but the popularity really has surged. But this year, so for instance, there's some data on Bloomberg that says over 550 of them have filed to go public in the US this year alone. So bear in mind, we're only in the middle of April. And they said that that was more than 2020 combined. So right now, they're really very hot. They're the thing to do. But the regulators are beginning to say, oh, you know, be careful here, because there can be less transparency. So investors, small investors, potentially could end up getting burnt by these if it all goes horribly wrong. So very, very popular, very, very hot at the moment, but they have been around for a long time.
Interesting. Katie, thanks for that. Katie, you mentioned super app. And I'm not sure that I get the idea, I think, of what you're talking about. Is it where you have an app and you could book a taxi or get your shopping or do your banking or something all in one? Is that the concept?
More or less, yes. So the huge in China, you know, Alipay, the likes of those. And basically, it's one app that you can do everything. So, from ordering a pizza to booking a flight to chatting to your mates to listening to music, you can do everything. They're kind of growing here in Asia, and I imagine they may well spread to the US and UK. They make life more convenient, but they're not quite yet fully here in Singapore.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of the nearest thing I have to that on my phone, and I can't quite think of one. Maybe, you know, my Google Maps enables me to open up a fair few things, and there's a lot of overlap between the different apps, but at the moment, not all in one. Maybe that is something we'll see one day. Katie, thank you. We'll let you go.
Cheers,
and prep for that leaving party for Sir James Dyson in the house down the road. Katie Silver there, living the high life in the estate behind Sir James in Singapore. I've got Taba Ahmed with me this morning, who is from Employability. She's the chief executive, the founder there, supporting disabled students and graduates into employment. Tab, the world of work at the minute, I mean, we've got to be talking about the world of work in different ways later in the show, about contracts changing for customers, the amount for staff, the amount that we should be taking a step back if we're working from home. But what have been the main trends of the last year that you've seen go on?
Well, for disability, at Employability, when we hit the pandemic, one of my big concerns was, is disability sort of going on the back burner for a lot of companies? As a diversity strand, it's always the poorer cousin anyway. And perhaps the least understood in many ways. And so I wasn't quite sure how that was going to impact disability in the workplace. But interestingly, what we found was that we became busier than ever as more and more companies wanted to engage with us to help become more sort of diverse and inclusive and create a sense of belonging within their organizations. And I think one of the reasons for that, I think there were two reasons. I think one of the reasons for that was actually overnight, we all saw we could do something differently, and perhaps where we thought we couldn't, perhaps have remote meetings or work from home, and suddenly we all could because we had to. So I think there was that concept of change is certainly possible. And then I think this whole idea that we've all been impacted in different ways by change based upon our own personal circumstances as well has led people to perhaps have more awareness of what difference can look like for us and how we can be impacted by that. And then I think the really big thing that happened this summer, of course, George Floyd and, you know, Black Lives Matter. And I think that that also made where all attention was going to shift perhaps for companies to kind of that diversity strand. But actually, again, I think overall that had a really positive impact on all diversity strands. And I think it made companies consider whether they want to be on the right side of history or the wrong side of history. So for us at Employability, you know, it's all about diversity, it's about the business case, but it's also about what we call the moral imperative. And I think the moral imperative, I think people have become much more aware of that in over the last year, because we've all undergone such an unusual year and had to cope with so many different things going on.
Have you seen that maybe the divides and the inequality that existed before the pandemic, you know, exacerbated at all? I'm just seeing, you know, headlines this morning, young black people have been hit hardest by unemployment during the pandemic. This is the Resolution Foundation saying the jobless rate for young black people rose by more than a third. It's now at 35%. Young people of Asian descent, it's 24%. For young white people, the unemployment rate is 13%. When you have those conversations with bosses, I wonder, you know, what changes are they making to make sure that doesn't get worse and worse? Because it obviously has already got worse for many people during a pandemic.
Yeah, so I think lots of different groups have been affected in different ways this year. I think young people in particular, perhaps young workers in particular, have been impacted. When we look at the sorts of sectors that young workers go into, whether that's perhaps leisure or those sorts of sectors or hospitality, perhaps that's, you know, well, we know that's been more impacted. And so I think that the sorts of roles available to young people, the sorts of roles that young people do have been fewer. So I think there has been more unemployment based upon that. And then, you know, you ask the question about sort of what can companies do, what can bosses do? So given that I think young people have been impacted particularly this year, you know, in education, in the roles available in all sorts of different ways, I think it's been tough for the young people that you are in some ways. But what can companies do? What can bosses do? Well, I think it's all for us, it's all about unemployability. It's all about what culture are you trying to create within your organization? Are you trying to create a culture of inclusion and belonging? Now, of course, you can't make somebody feel that they belong. They have to feel it. So what do you do within your organization to create that environment, that culture of belonging? And at Employability, we place a lot of emphasis on the education piece. And what I mean by that is we call it our disability empowerment training. So as far as disability is concerned, so just focusing on that for a moment, I know there's been this article this morning about the drop in employment for young Black people, but just focusing on disability because that's really where we come in. Mm. Education is quite important, particularly around disability. There's a lot of misunderstanding, misconceptions about what disability is, what does it mean. People typically, when I run training sessions with companies, tend to think of disability. I say, you know, what's the first thing that comes into your head when you think of disability? And typically, and understandably in many ways, it's somebody in a wheelchair, somebody with a very physical condition, appearance, as opposed to perhaps a neurodiversity or mental health. But interestingly, 70% or more than 70% of disabilities are non-visible. If we look at that definition of disability, which is about any physical or mental condition that has a long-term substantial impact on your ability to carry out normal day-to-day activities, well, over 70% of those are non-visible. So unless somebody tells you they have a condition, whether it's dyslexia or ADHD or anxiety or depression, unless they tell you, or a long-term health condition, then you won't know. And for people with neurodiversity or mental health conditions, for example, they're very good at masking and managing and coping with the condition they have so that they can create a normal appearance to the rest of the world. So I think there's a lot of understanding needs to take place for companies to be able to think about an inclusive culture. What can managers do? What can colleagues do to be supportive of somebody with a disability?
Interesting. I mean, if you're a boss out there and, you know, you've been dealing with that situation maybe for the first time, and there are things that you've done that have worked for you, do let us know. 85058, hashtag wake up to money. If you want to send us a tweet this morning, going to be talking to Tab and Jane about many more things after we've gone through the news and sport. But if you do want to get in touch, please do. 85058.
Listen on BBC Sounds. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News headlines for you this morning. The committee which advises ministers on vaccine use in the UK says it will look very carefully at the data surrounding the Johnson & Johnson COVID jab. It's after the US, South Africa and the EU temporarily suspended it over safety concerns. Six US women, all under the age of 50, have developed rare but severe blood clots. Egypt is demanding $900 million from the owners of the giant tanker that got stuck in the Suez Canal for 6 days. An Egyptian court ordered the seizure of the Ever Given until its Japanese owners compensate the Suez Canal Authority for costs. A new research from a think tank suggests that young Black and Asian workers have been hit hardest by the rise in unemployment caused by the pandemic. Resolution Foundation found that the unemployment rate is 35% for Black workers and 24% for Asians, compared to 13% for their white counterparts. They're the news headlines for you this morning. Here with the sport, Andy Barwell.
Although Chelsea went down 1-0 on the night to the Portuguese side Porto, Thomas Tuchel's team reached the last four of the Champions League with a 2-1 overall success. Tuchel admitted that both games weren't the nicest to watch. Chelsea will next face the winners of the quarter-final between Liverpool and Real Madrid, who face each other at Anfield this evening. The Liverpool boss Jurgen Klopp says his side must go for it as they're 3-1 down going into the second leg. Manchester City take a 2-1 lead to Germany's Borussia Dortmund. The winners will face Paris Saint-Germain in the last four. Although PSG were beaten 1-0 by the reigning title holders Bayern Munich, it was 3-3 on aggregate. The French side went through on the away goals rule. Northern Ireland made history in reaching next year's Women's European Championship finals in England. Marissa Callahan and Nadine Caldwell scored in a 2-0 win on the night, 4-1 overall against Ukraine. The Euro 2022 finals will be Northern Ireland's first major tournament. In international friendlies, England's Lionesses lost 2-0 at home to Canada. Wales women drew 1-1 with Denmark. And the England cricket star Ben Stokes is out of the rest of the Indian Premier League after suffering a broken finger in his opening match for the Rajasthan Royals.
That is the sports headlines for you this morning. Here with the weather, Nick Miller.
Good morning. Pretty quiet weather around for the rest of the week with high pressure keeping most places dry. Just as we saw on Tuesday, though, there were some showers that developed and there'll be a few again in the day ahead, though most will be dry with a mixture of cloud and sunny spells. Of course, what has got us all talking at the moment is just how chilly it is for the time of year. There's another widespread frost out there to start the day, another hard frost in parts of Scotland. And, well, a lot of dry weather to begin with, but yes, it's on the chilly side. And temperatures for the rest of the week will only be close to average, but if anything, across the eastern areas of the UK, it's about to turn a bit colder once again. Let's look around the UK today, starting in Scotland, sunny spells. Chance of a shower today, more especially towards the south and west. Again, very hit and miss. Many places will stay dry. In Northern Ireland, sunny spells. You may find an isolated shower. Most places won't. Across northwest England, the West Midlands, southwest England, and Wales today. Here, sunny spells. Dry morning, but the odd shower developing during the day. Very hit and miss. For southeast England, eastern England, and northeast England, it'll be mainly dry. Now, some areas of cloud, but also some sunny spells. Now, temperatures today for most parts of the UK in the range of 10 to 13 degrees Celsius. But for eastern coastal parts of Scotland, but particularly down the eastern side of England, there is a northeasterly breeze developing, and that's from a colder direction as it moves in off that North Sea. So here, temperatures may be just around 7 to 9 degrees, the closer you are to the North Sea coast through the course of this afternoon. Tonight, any showers that have developed will fade away. We're left with another widespread frost going into Thursday, another mainly dry day with some sunny spells. Nick Miller, 5 Live Weather.
BBC Sounds.
Meet Sam, mother of four, enjoys tinkering with cars, born and raised in the sleepy American suburbs. So how did she end up living with extremists in Syria?
I'm not a bad person. I'm not a monster.
And then there's this IT technician. He's in his 30s and goes on business trips to China. Why is he on the FBI's most wanted list?
What started out as cybercrime is now tipping into threats of real-world violence.
There's more than meets the eye. Listen to I'm Not a Monster, The Lazarus Heist, and more true crime podcasts on the BBC Sounds app.
Wake up to money with Sean Farrington.
Hello, thank you for being with us on this Wednesday morning. It's the 14th of April. This is Wake Up to Money. We've been talking Tesco already this morning, expecting their update on how the last year has been for them. You can get the podcast on BBC Sounds if you want to hear our analysis of the changing technology, changing customer habits. How much money do we have in our pockets to be spending in our supermarkets? We're going to talk a little more in a moment about the story on the front page of almost all the papers. I'd Phil be in touch with me from Ripon. She says, my lockdown version 3 has ended thus. Yesterday a swim, then gym and massage. Today, pedicure. Haircut must wait another 12 days. Birthday supper outside. Table booked for a week tomorrow. All priorities addressed and breathed, she says. Shopping I have no need for. Well, you must do it at some point, Phil, but maybe not in the itinerary of lockdown easing that so many are looking at playing out over the next few days. But big story that is, well, it's around every day at the moment, is the Greensill Capital lobbying scandal. There's a lot to get into here. Let me just read you a few headlines on the front pages of the papers. Daily Mail, Cameron Mandarin snared by lobbying scandal revealed. Top civil servant allowed to work for Greensill board while still in Whitehall. Sleazy access on the front page of the Daily Mirror, alongside a picture that many have picked up of David Cameron sitting alongside a glowing fire outdoors in a suit alongside Lex Greensill, who is the founder, the boss of Greensill Capital, and they're in Saudi Arabia for a meeting with, as the Times puts it, for a meeting with the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Now, this Greensill Capital is the company we've been talking about that has collapsed. It's gone bust. Its finances are intrinsically linked with the steel industry in the UK as well. It's a story that's caught big business, the government, former Prime Minister David Cameron in its web. The Greensill Capital story, it blew up on March the 1st when it sought insolvency protection itself in Australia. But how have we got to this point? Well, I've got Mark Rubenstein with me, who's the former hedge fund manager at Lansdowne Partners, one of Europe's largest hedge fund firms, and a financial companies expert along with that. Morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Sean.
Can we go back to, say, 2011, when Greensill was founded, Lex Greensill started this business? What was the aim of this company?
Well, so Lex Greensill is an Australian. He has farming roots, quite humble roots. He launched Greensill Capital, as you say, in 2011, inspired partly by his experiences in Australia, where he claims he found it often very difficult as a small company, a small supplier, to get paid on time by the big companies he did business with. So the idea behind his business was simply that Greensill Capital would insert themselves between big companies. So Vodafone, for example, Vodafone was a client, and the suppliers with whom they worked. Now, clearly, every big company has a range of suppliers. Normally, they get paid between 30 and 180 days after they gave their services. Greensill came along and said, well, hang on a sec, maybe these small suppliers want to get paid quicker, and maybe the big company can do that via us at a discount. So what he did is he basically said, don't worry, we will pay you immediately, small supplier, but we won't pay you 100p in the pound, we'll pay you 95p in the pound or whatever. And that's how Greensill made its money. And the big company, Vodafone, to use my example, would pay Greensill back in 30 to 180 days' time.
Right.
So basically, they sat between the big companies and the small-ish suppliers.
And this business caught the eye of the government at the time. You know, David Cameron, Prime Minister from 2010 to 2016. And it was during that time that Lex Greensill was recruited by the Cabinet Office as one of six new Crown representatives to help tackle wasteful contracts, make sure suppliers provided the best value for money. All of that was the idea of that role. But how did he become so close to the government, and what role did he actually end up playing?
Well, it's quite interesting. So before founding Greensill in 2011, he'd worked at a couple of investment banks. He'd worked at Morgan Stanley. He'd worked at Citigroup. Apparently at Citigroup, he met somebody who was to go on and become a senior civil service member who introduced him to David Cameron in turn. That was his entry into Whitehall, if you like. But he was a great salesman. He is a great salesman. Lex Greensill, less of a financial engineer. The company itself was promoted as a pioneer of financial technology. Truth is, they didn't have that much technology. A lot of that was outsourced. But he was a great salesman, and he sold this idea to not only Downing Street, but to investors, some very big investors who bankrolled the company. He sold them this idea that he could ease and make more efficient this whole supply chain finance role, which is this role where he basically puts himself between the companies and their suppliers.
And as we know now, you know, since leaving office, David Cameron took up an advisor post at that business, which is why a lot of the headlines are being generated over the last week or two, because of David Cameron's contacts with government. So that's where the link between David Cameron and Lex Greensill came along. What about then? What happened at Greensill Capital? What went wrong? And how does Liberty Steel, which supposedly was a saviour of our steel industry a few years ago, how does that come into it?
Well, it's a very interesting question, Sean. We fast forward now, we're in 2018. General Atlantic, one of the big technology-oriented investment firms in the US, injected $250 million into Greensill. And from what we understand today, that was basically the validation for David Cameron to get involved. So David Cameron then got involved in 2018 on the basis of the credibility that had been bestowed on the company by General Atlantic. In 2019, SoftBank, a big technology investor itself, $100 billion fund, invested significant amounts of money in Greensill, and he grew. Greensill and the company grew. But at the end of the day, there wasn't that much demand for the end product. The big companies, the kind of Vodafones that I mentioned, one can question what was in it for them. They were what was in it for them. And so Greensill basically worked with a small number of companies, ultimately. You mentioned GFG Alliance, owned by Sanjeev Gupta. That was one. He worked with a couple of other companies, NMC Health, not that many companies. And he basically lent money to them in quite significant amounts. He wasn't a bank. This is also important to remember. He wasn't a bank. So normally a bank would kind of fund their loans with deposits. He wasn't able to raise deposits. And so this is where Credit Suisse comes along. He basically used Credit Suisse to sell his loans that he originated to their clients. And so a $10 billion fund was raised at Credit Suisse, which basically helped him fund those loans to companies like GFG Alliance, Vodafone, et cetera, et cetera.
And eventually they thought, we don't want any more of this, and things unraveled.
Exactly. So you mentioned the 1st of March. Yeah. On the 1st of March, Credit Suisse turned around and said, hang on a sec, these kind of $10 billion of assets that we're managing aren't actually worth $10 billion after all. And they froze redemptions on those funds. And actually, just this week, they announced that they've been able to repay something like 50p in the pound, but there's still 50p that they're searching for.
Well, Mark, it's a great refresher and important for, as we see the lobbying scandal, which we'll have more discussion about on Wake Up to Money, to remember where all this came from, what the financial issues were behind it. Of course, you know, the paying and employing people for access to government is a massive controversy right now, and we'll see where that goes. Mark Rubenstein, thank you. Sure, we'll catch up again. A former hedge fund manager at Lansdowne Partners, one of Europe's largest hedge fund firms. Let's talk British Gas now, shall we? Today, the deadline for 7,500 British Gas engineers to accept the new terms and conditions or face being sacked by the parent company, Centrica. The dispute involves staff whose service and repair boilers has been going on for 9 months now over what the GMB union say are the company's fire and rehire tactics. Under the new terms, staff would be required to work extra hours, would not get extra money for working weekends or public holidays. British Gas say 95% of affected workers have signed the new contracts. The GMB union disagrees. I've got Andy Prendergast with me, who is the acting national secretary at the union. Morning Andy, have we got you? Well, we will speak to Andy very shortly. Let's talk to Jane Foley about what's going on in the rest of the world. I'll sum it up in that way. Jane, head of FX strategy at Rabobank. Jane, we've talked about Grab and SPACs. If people missed that earlier, you can catch that on the podcast. Let's talk Babcock, shall we? Yesterday morning, we heard Babcock, the big defence business, saying it could be racking up £1 billion of losses, 1,000 jobs going to be axed. Is this just another business saying we've had a tough pandemic, or is there something more underlying, sort of longer term than this?
Well, in a way, we hope that it is just another business. I mean, it does say that it has had higher costs adapting to work in the pandemic, and also weak trading in civil aviation operations. I think we can all understand why in the civil aspect. The news that we've seen right now, oddly enough, you have seen the share price react positively to this. And I think investors like to see all of the bad news out there and then see a plan of action as to what they're going to do. So what they have announced is that profits are going to be about 30 million lower a year for a future period. So there are going to be less profits. But it comes perhaps at a sensitive time. We saw a couple of weeks ago that the British Army is going to be cut. by over 72,000 troops by 2025. And, you know, we've got Brexit, and I think there are various questions about, you know, the shape of our defence, particularly when you've got Russian troops amassing at the Ukraine border as well. But the Ministry of Finance is going to be spending a lot more money, $85 billion on equipment over the next 4 years. That should give reassurances. And I think perhaps the news that we see from Babcock today should just be seen in the sense of a company that has had higher costs and is adapting. And that's the sort of news that we've had today.
Here's a wide-ranging question for you, Jane. What's going on with the new Brexit rules? Because in the last sort of 24 hours, we've had JD Sports saying, the boss there saying that it turned out to be considerably worse than he'd feared, the new Brexit rules. He said that before, and yesterday the company announced it was planning to open a huge warehouse near Dublin to tackle post-Brexit trade problems. We had new trade, import and export figures. The exports bounced back from the lows of January, but imports not quite so much. We heard Sir James Dyson earlier saying he thought it had been a success. He can now employ the people he wants in the UK. What's really going on?
Well, I think for JD, I mean, this perhaps is a situation that many businesses, I mean, JD obviously a bigger company, we've had news like this from smaller companies too. Brexit is creating some issues. There is red tape. There are tariffs on certain types of imports, exports, etc. And what JD do, of course, they bring in goods from that are made in Eastern Asia and they sell them. Now, once they bring them in to the UK, they're concerned that they bring them perhaps across to Ireland or into the other parts of the EU, and they have to pay various different tariffs. So they're avoiding the UK. They're going to bring in their goods from their Eastern Asia straight into Dublin, which is, of course, in the EU. They've already got a big warehouse in Belgium, and then they can distribute from there. So clearly, they'll still be bringing goods that they're going to distribute into the UK. But goods that are going to be distributed in the EU, they're just going to sidestep the UK.
Thank you, Jane. I think I've got Andy Prendergast with us now, the GMB Union's acting national secretary, to talk about British Gas engineers. Andy, morning to you.
Good morning.
Morning. Now, British Gas say 95% of affected workers have signed the new contracts. Do you not see that as the case?
Well, I mean, that's over a working population of about 20,000 people, and these are issues that largely affect a lot of their field force. It's true to say a large number of our members have signed, but that's because they have an option either of signing a significantly worse new contract or effectively being sacked tomorrow. So I wouldn't take the fact that they've signed as an agreement or a vote in favour of this deal.
We were talking last week on Wake Up to Money about, you know, the legalities around this, and it's, you know, businesses can go through this process of trying to do that. There may be small print in people's contracts that enables employers to be able to do this. So what is your issue as a union with what British Gas are doing?
Well, if you look, they're engaging in something called fire and rehire. Now, this used to be an obscure bit of the law, but it's been used more and more by companies, whereby effectively they terminate your contract without an offer of redundancy, without compensation, and dismiss you if you don't accept the new terms. Now, this is a practice that has been called by our Prime Minister as unacceptable. It's been slammed by the leaders of the Labour Party, the leader of the Scottish Assembly, the leaders of the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Assembly. And ultimately, it's just simply not right. You know, we work on the basis in this country that if you have a contract, that contract is sacrosanct. This allows a company to change that unilaterally, and that's what we fundamentally disagree with.
Do we work on that basis, though? Because, you know, we've spent a lot of the last few weeks talking about the gig economy, the changing habits of workers, and alongside that, the changing habits of customers, which have meant businesses have to change one way or another. British Gas saying, we're not changing base salaries or pensions. Our engineers will remain some of the best paid in the sector, earning £40,000 a year minimum. Are there not steps that you need to make representing those workers to sort of ensure they have a job suitable for a 21st century economy?
Well, we've had a long history with British Gas. We've been the largest union in there since the company was created. And over that period of time, we have agreed a number of changes to terms and conditions. That's a regular process for any union. I think the issue here, and you've mentioned the gig economy, is there's a wider question about the economy as a whole. Do we want people and have the workforce with no job security, with no guaranteed earnings? Or do we want one where people are allowed to thrive? Now, you've mentioned the £40,000 level there. We're talking about trained gas engineers who have to do long apprenticeships, who are highly skilled. And also, every time they do a job, they can technically end up in prison if that goes wrong. Now, this is a workforce called by the company themselves as a unique asset, highly trained. And unfortunately, the company's actions have disenfranchised and demoralised every single one of them. And that's before we get to the very real possibility that hundreds and hundreds of trained, long-serving engineers with decades worth of experience are going to be fired from that company tomorrow.
And so how many do you expect to not sign and be in that situation, did you say?
We're certainly expecting hundreds. And ultimately, even those who have signed largely have done so not because they agree with a contract, but simply because they want a job.
Well, Andy, thank you for being with us this morning on Wake Up to Money. If you're one of those involved, if you're one of those engineers, you may be one who's signed the contract, one who hasn't yet, maybe you won't, do get in touch with us, 85058, hashtag Wake Up to Money. We'd love to hear your views on that. That was Andy Prendergast, the GMB Union's acting national secretary. Tim in South London has been in touch. He says, well done. Thanks for that primer on Greensill. Best one I've come across. Between Credit Suisse and the lobbying scandal, it sounds like the owner was a great salesman, perhaps not such a formidable businessman. If you missed that, we just got to the crux of the story on the front pages of almost every single paper, tabloid, broadsheet this morning. Pictures of David Cameron. What is really going on there? Right. The right to disconnect. Disconnect. If you've been working from home, it can be difficult, can't it? Now, the business secretary said the right to disconnect should be part of the government thinking on the labour market. Kwasi Kwarteng made his comments during a Commons committee hearing where he was asked about hybrid working. During the pandemic, lots of people have switched to working from home, haven't they? Peaking about 15 million, almost half of the working population. It's dipped, but still a third. Survey by the Union Prospect found two-thirds of those working from home wanted the UK to follow the lead of countries such as Ireland, which brought in the right to disconnect last month. I've got Alison Loveday, employment law solicitor, partner at Kennedy's with me now. Morning, Alison.
Good morning.
What can the right to disconnect actually mean in terms of, you know, we're talking about contracts people are signing, British Gas-wise, but just generally, how can you get this right to disconnect and what can it entitle you to?
Well, at the moment here in the UK, we don't have it, other than certainly protections, things like the Working Time Directive and health and safety legislation, which might mean you could request it. But generally, it's to introduce a culture or a code of practice where employees don't feel the pressure to effectively be on all the time. So there are rules around when individuals can either send or access and receive their emails and other work communication.
Right. And so, if say, we lived in Ireland and we were able to have these rights, how strong are your rights versus the employer? Can you just say, I'm not doing that, and they have to go along with it?
No, I mean, it's very new legislation. So certainly in Ireland, there is a code of practice, so it's not a legal requirement, and also it's the right to within it to request the right to work remotely, and also then the right to disconnect. So I think we'll have to see how it plays out in practice. I think the other thing to remember, it was famously brought in France in 2017, but there again, it's not a law as such, as in a legal requirement, more than they have to, each employer who employs more than 50 people have to draw up a charter. So I think it's quite important for employers to understand that. So there's a recognition that it's not one size fits all, and that what suits one employer and one business won't be right for another.
You say it's also famously, sorry to interrupt, Alison, but you say famously brought in France. I mean, was there something in particular learnt about how it was done in France?
I think it's interesting because that was a response to a recognition that there's so much information overload. I think they actually called it information obesity, and that was the response there to that rather than COVID. Whereas I think in Ireland and here in the UK, it's been a response to how people are saying they want to work and a recognition that we are pretty much stuck in an archaic nine to working arrangement that be. So looking to future-proof the workforce.
Thank you. We'll see if that ever gets in place in the UK. Alison Loveday, their employment law solicitor, partner at Kennedy's. Tab Ahmed has been with me, the founder and chief executive of Employability. Tab, I mean, that links in with what we were talking about a bit earlier, about what you would like to see in changes in the workplace.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, over this last year, we've been working remotely. I think the lines between work and private time have become very, very fuzzy. And as we kind of move to the new ways of working, new patterns of working, which certainly isn't going to return to what we had before, I think companies really need to be thinking about what they can do to, as has been said, to kind of future-proof that, but also to ensure that people have very distinct difference between work time and leisure time. And I think particularly important, people with disabilities, who need to really manage that for purposes of mental health.
Tab, thanks for being with us this morning. Enjoy your meal tomorrow night. Is it was it tomorrow night? You've got it booked?
Tomorrow night, yeah. Yes, thank you.
Very exciting. Get the big coat on, woolly hat maybe. Enjoy that first drink. Let's get that seat. We're going to be pushing for that seat nearest the outdoor heater, aren't we? That's going to be the new task and skill we're all going to learn this spring. Tab Ahmed there, who is the founder and chief executive of Employability. Big thanks to Jane Foley as well, who's with us from Rabobank this morning. Thank you to everybody who's been in touch. Variety of topics. Oh, there you go, Chris. We're lining up our week. It's warming up.
I can only say thank you to you as well, Sean, seeing as you've thanked everybody else. See you after the news.
The Voice of the UK. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Wednesday the 14th of April. Good morning, this is Justine Green. A British trial examining whether COVID vaccines can be mixed between doses is being expanded to encompass the new Moderna and Novavax jabs. President Biden's climate envoy John Kerry is on his way to China to try to agree cuts in